Welcome to the London Buddhist Centre's podcast, bringing you the Dharma and guided meditations. If you found value in listening, please consider making a donation. We hope you enjoy this episode.
So my name is Nyan Vacha, for those of you who don't know me. And we are going to have three evenings looking at this text, the Bardo Tadol, which in English was translated in 1927, or at least part of it was, and became known as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So we're going to try and approach that using just one section of the text called the Root Verses of the Six Bardos, which is a sort of essentialized meditative, it can be a meditation text that you can use to reflect not just on death, but on life. So we'll be looking at the root verses of the six bardos over 3 weeks. Yeah, so that's what we'll be doing. So what I thought I'd do is I'll read you those verses, and then we'll go into a period of the mindfulness of breathing. And I'll lead us in a body scan and groundedness in the mindfulness of breathing when we get to that. But let's begin with the root verses. So you might want to now set yourself up for meditation. And if you need more cushions, as I say, do raise your hand. We can get more stuff. So taking a few moments to just settle into your posture. Particularly having a sense of the weight of the body dropping through the cushions or through the chair into the ground. Beginning with a few deeper out breaths, deeper in breaths, longer out breaths. And particularly resting your awareness just below the navel. See if you can feel the breath in the belly. And you can just listen to these words of the root verses. Whether you understand all of them or not, it's not important for now. Just letting the words sink in. The root verses of the six bardos. Oh, now, when the bardo of life upon me is dawning, abandoning idleness, there being no idleness in a devotee's life, entering into the reality undistractedly, listening, reflecting, and meditating, carrying on to the path knowledge of the true nature of appearances and of mind, may the Trikaya be realized. Once that the human form has been attained, may there be no time or opportunity in which to idle it away. O now, when the bardo of dreams upon me is dawning, abandoning the inordinate corpse-like sleeping of the sleep of stupidity, may the consciousness undistractedly be kept in its natural state. Comprehending the true nature of dreams, may I train myself in the clear light of miraculous transformation, acting not like the brutes in slothfulness. May the blending of the practicing of the sleep state and the actual or waking experience be highly valued by me. O now, when the bardo of meditation upon me is dawning, abandoning the whole mass of distractions and illusions, may the mind be kept at rest in endless, undistracted samadhi. May firmness both in the visualizing and in the perfecting stages be obtained. At this time, when meditating one-pointedly, with all other actions put aside, may I not fall under the power of misleading, stupefying passions. O now, when the bardo of the moment of death upon me is dawning, abandoning attraction and craving and weakness for all worldly things, may I be undistracted in the space of the bright enlightening teachings. May I be able to transfuse myself into the heavenly space of the unborn. The hour has come to part with this body composed of flesh and blood. May I know the body to be impermanent and illusory. O now, when the bardo of reality upon me is dawning, abandoning all awe, fear, and terror of all phenomena, may I recognize whatever appears as being my own thought forms. May I know them to be apparitions in the intermediate state. It has been said, there arrives a time when the chief turning point is reached. Fear not the bands of the peaceful and wrathful who are your own thought forms. O now, when the bardo of taking rebirth upon me is dawning, one-pointedly holding fast to a single wish, may I be able to continue the course of good deeds through repeated effort. May the womb door be closed and revulsion recollected. The hour has come when energy and pure love are needed. May I cast off jealousy and meditate upon the Guru, the Father Mother. O procrastinating one, who thinks not of the coming of death, devoting yourself to the useless doings of this life, improvident are you in dissipating your great opportunity. Mistaken indeed will your purpose be now, if you return empty-handed from this life. Since the Holy Dharma is known to be your true need, will you not devote yourself to the Holy Dharma, even now?
mindfulness of breathing.
Yes, I want to begin by not looking so much directly at these verses that we've just heard, those verses of the root verses of the six bardos, but start really exploring what we think about death and the notion of death and our views about what happens after death. The Buddhist view, the Buddha's view, and the whole of the Buddhist tradition since the Buddha's time has always maintained that death is not the end of consciousness, that we are not just a physical being. Buddhism says primarily we're consciousness made into matter, we're embodied consciousness, and that something of the mind, of stream of consciousness, you could say, will continue after death. But you don't have to believe that in order to be a Buddhist. You don't have to take that on the Buddha's word or my word or anybody's word to be a Buddhist. In a sense, Buddhism is primarily concerned about what we do in this life. Nevertheless, it'd be interesting to see, let's just have a show of hands to see if you do think that there's something beyond death. Okay, so that's about half the room in here, and I can't see if you've raised your hand at home. You can raise your hand next door, I can't see. But let's say about 50%. And let's see if there's anybody who just says they don't know. They're agnostic. Yeah, so that's a fair few. And then others who think definitely there's nothing beyond death. Yeah, okay. So actually that's a minority of hands in this room who think that there's nothing. There's a majority of people who either are agnostic or think that there's something continuing beyond death. The reason that, in a way, it's important to at least ask those questions and think about it is because I think how we view what happens after death colours how we approach life. It'll certainly colour how you approach the practice of the Dharma. Buddhism is aiming at this completely liberated transcendent state called enlightenment, or Bodhi. And it's said to be a liberation from all greed, hatred and delusion, all self-centered emotions and ways of conceiving of our experience. It's also, though, said to be a liberation from the round of birth and death. So if you don't, as a Buddhist, accept that there's something beyond death, then enlightenment for you is about a state achieved in this life only. And my teacher, Sangharakshita Bhante, says, that's fair enough. It just means that you have to attain enlightenment in this life. You've only got this life to do it. That means you've got to get a move on. Yeah. For me, though, I must say that if there was nothing beyond death, if I thought that there was nothing beyond death, I'm not sure I would be so attracted to the notion of enlightenment as conceived of in the Buddhist path as a freedom of greed, hatred and delusion. I think I might decide at some point that, well, I'm happy enough and I'll settle for that for the rest of my years. After all, if you're a practicing Buddhist, it's quite an arduous path. And at times, you're inviting difficulties that you wouldn't have otherwise faced if you weren't a practicing Buddhist. I won't go into the sorts of difficulties that you... But if you're working on your mind in that conscious way, it's quite an arduous thing. The Buddha said that enlightenment, to gain enlightenment, was the most difficult thing that a human being could do. So personally, I prefer to see it in terms of lifetimes, as if I'm on a quest over lifetimes. If it was just this lifetime, I think I might put my feet up. So that's one response. On the other hand, I know some people who have said, look, if it's all over lifetimes and there's an infinite number of lifetimes, then they put their feet up. They can't, you know, that there's no urgency then. So it's a quite an individual response as to what your practice of the Dharma would look like if you didn't believe that something existed beyond death. All I'm trying to say is that it will affect your approach to the Dharma life in some way or t'other. Yeah? Better if it affects it towards urgency rather than complacency. I think also it's worth thinking about in another way, which is I think it's only when we consider mortality that we can often reflect on what's really important in our lives. Often we live in a rather unconscious way, doing what everybody else does, or thinking we're sort of doing what everybody else expects, without really questioning what's really important to us in our lives. And often it's only when we reflect on death that we start to prioritize. I think that's been sort of true in my experience. When I was 11, my dad died. And that his death, which was quite sudden, definitely propelled me into questioning what life was for. And I was definitely convinced that most of the adults around me, I didn't really know what life was for, but I knew that the adults around me who were, I don't know, getting on with jobs and, you know, they were fine people, mortgages, holidays, cars, that wasn't it. That wasn't it in the face of the fact that you could suddenly die. That really couldn't be it. At least that was my sort of takeaway, or one of the learnings from my father's death. I think it's also important to sort of, I don't know, just reflect on what would it be like when you come to die? Say you do have a clear mind when you come to die, what would you regret not doing in your life? One of the things that Buddhists sometimes do is, in a way, think about their own funeral and what they would like. I recently went to an order member's funeral, and she'd planned her funeral and knew exactly what she wanted to have at that funeral. And she'd thought about, in a way, anything that was left over in her life, and she'd made her peace with everything. I think it's important to kind of do that. What is it that you might want to do before you die? I think relationships, for example, are very, very important. Nobody will regret not having the latest iPhone. Nobody, on their deathbed, will regret not having a bigger house. And what people tend to want is, well, certainly when my father died, on his deathbed, he was having a heart attack. And one of the things he said to me, he held my hand and he said he hadn't been kind enough in his life. He'd not been kind enough, that he'd hurt people and there was regret. And that stays with me, that regret that he had stays with me, and it's influenced how I live my life. I think it's just worth reflecting on what will stay with you if you reflect on death. Also, I've been sort of reading about near-death experiences, and there's a growing literature on people who have had near-death experiences. Presumably, it's growing because with the advance of medicine and the ability to resuscitate people, particularly from cardiac arrest, more people sort of die and then come back. And there's a growing literature of some people's near-death experiences. And it's worth reading if you're interested. There's a book that I recently read by a medic called Dr. Bruce Grayson. I believe he's an American, possibly at the University of Virginia. And he, over many years, interviewed people who had near-death experiences. And he started off a skeptic. You know, he's trained in allopathic medicine. He's a Westerner. He started off thinking that there was something probably going on in the brain that you could account, that could account for these experiences. He ends up convinced that these experiences are genuine. His book is called After. It's worth looking up. It's worth looking up. For example, one patient of his who had a near-death experience on the operating table, she reported seeing what was going on in the operating room, but more than that, she reported on seeing what was going on in the room next door. And he was in the room next door, I think, for a while after she died. And that morning, he'd spilt some of his breakfast on his shirt. There was a stain on his shirt, which was covered over with a tie. But when he was in the room next door, I think he sort of took his tie off. She reported seeing a stain on his shirt, like a ketchup stain or something. And, you know, there are stories like that which convinced him that death wasn't the end. And he ends up saying that consciousness, he thinks, is somehow primary. Another book that I read is by Jim Tucker, who is also an academic, researching into children with past life memories. So it's a slightly different approach. And apparently, kids, particularly if they're under the age of, I don't know, before five, often have memories of previous lives, and he sort of manages to get their stories. And the ones that are most remarkable are stories where the kid is saying that they were such and such in a previous life with a name and an occupation, and even some of them saying how they died. There was this little boy who was obsessed with aeroplanes and said that he was a fighter pilot, and this is where he died. And he names the ship, the aircraft carrier that he was part of, and his best friend who was on that ship, etc., etc. Anyway, these were verifiable facts. Do you sort of mean that Jim Tucker was able to then research into? So when you have an under five-year-old telling you about World War II and the aircraft and so forth, it certainly bears thinking about. So Jim Tucker, I recommend. Penny Sartori, have you heard of Penny Sartori? She's retired, I believe, but she was a nurse, then became an academic, researching into near-death experiences. She's Welsh, and Maitreya Bandhu interviewed her for Poetry East. No, he didn't, for Nature of Mind. So somewhere on the internet, around the LBC's YouTube page, possibly, you've got an interview with Penny Sartori. And what's lovely about Penny Sartori, I don't know if you're watching, Penny, forgive me if you are, is she's so down to earth. She's not, she's just salt of the earth Welsh person. And she's completely convinced, having had a lifetime, well, I don't know how long, working as a palliative care nurse, and seeing lots of people die, and have reports of them seeing something as they're dying. And then recently I've been reading Ian McGilchrist. He doesn't have any near-death experiences. He's a sort of psychiatrist and a philosopher. One of the things I think, from a philosophical perspective, it's worth thinking about is that if matter is all there is, if we are just physical beings, biological, material entities, how does consciousness, how does this experience of being aware come about? And Ian McGilchrist is he's a medic as well, a psychiatrist, but he... He's also a philosopher and a professor of English, and he's a polymath. he really looks at this from a philosophical angle, as well as from a neuroscience kind of angle. And all I can say is that science doesn't have anything to say about how this experience of being conscious comes around from matter alone. Ian McGilchrist's view is that, look, either there is something miraculous that happens in the brain and consciousness is a byproduct of all those neurons firing. That's one possibility. Or, he says, the brain could be like a receiver of consciousness. Like a radio is a receiver of radio waves. And obviously, if the radio breaks down, then you can't receive the radio waves. So the brain does seem to act as some sort of necessary equipment, as it were. But the brain and the radio is not the source of the radio waves. Does that make sense? He talks about a receiver model. He also talks about a transmitter model. I'm not going to go into that. It's a bit more subtle. Anyway, I mention all of that because if you are either agnostic or, well, actually, whatever view you have, it might be interesting for you to explore what some Western thinkers, contemporary Western thinkers, are saying about death and what happens after. Personally, I studied physics when I was a young man, and I think I partly was interested in, I don't know, understanding or trying to understand the secrets of the universe. And I don't think I did. I mean, I wasn't very good at physics. I found out too late. One thing that I was left with, though, was a complete conviction through studying physics, let alone anything else, that common sense reality is not what is real. Yeah. That common sense, our common sense perception is a complete illusion. Einstein said that common sense was a set of prejudices that were put down into our psyche by the age of 18. I think it might be even earlier than that. But common sense reality is not real. So matter, for example, we're quite quick to think that, yes, matter is the primary reality. We believe in atoms, and we think that's what we might be. Everything might be. If you have studied modern physics, you'll know that matter is a mystery. We don't have a final theory of matter. And what we do have is so outrageous that, well, nobody really understands it. Nobody understands quantum mechanics. If Feynman said that if you think you've understood quantum mechanics, you haven't. And what's more, there is no consensus as to what the equations of quantum mechanics mean in terms of real life. We know that the maths works. We don't know how to interpret it. So if you are going to be a materialist, I'd say be a quantum matter materialist. Yeah? Don't be 19th century about your view of matter. That's what most people are, though. And I think the medical profession is partly to blame. The medical profession, biology, etc., wonderful though they are, has still not taken on board physics, largely. I mean, that's changing. But largely, medics still view the body as a machine. I saw Ian McGilchrist give a lecture at the Royal College of Physicians, talking to hundreds of medics, actually mostly retired. It was a daytime lecture. And he said that this mechanistic view of the body is a real disservice. I can't remember his words, but he said we've got it wrong. He also said that the medical profession has turned death into a problem, into a failure. But it's the only certainty. Yeah. So doctors will talk about having failed when they lose a patient, or when somebody with a terminal illness finally dies. It's seen as if they've lost the battle. And Ian McGilchrist said, look, we've got it very, very wrong if you've set yourself up as death is the failure when you know that that's what's going to happen. Yeah, that is the only certainty. So anyway, I'll stop talking about sort of Western science and things. Buddhism has always said that death is not the end. It's always asked us to reflect on the fact of death and the fact that we don't know when the time of death will be. And it does so not to spook us, not to stress us out, but in order to ask us to look at the life that we're leading now and to make sure that it's a meaningful one. Yeah. So Buddhism's never shied away from death. And yes, it has always had this notion that death isn't the end. Maybe I'll come back to what the Buddhist notion is as we explore these root verses. So the Tibetan Book of the Dead is, so I've got a copy here of a complete translation. This is the only complete translation, not this copy, I mean, this edition is the only complete translation that's yet been done into English. In 1927, Dr. Evans Wentz, I don't know what he was, he translated one chapter, chapter 11, as it is in this, and called it the Tibetan Book of the Dead because I think people knew about the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and so he'd riffed off that title, and it became world famous. It became extremely well known. Actually, in Tibet, it's not that well known. The Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is actually a translation of the Tibetan text called the Bardo Tadol, is just one strand of the Tibetan lineage. It comes from the Nyingma tradition, which is one of the four main schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And it's quite a minor kind of text. It's just become very, very famous in the West. It's not the only Buddhist view of what happens at death. Actually, there is no real consensus Buddhist view at what happens at death. What there is a consensus about is that death isn't the end, and that there is rebirth, particularly if we don't reach enlightenment, either in this life or in the bardo, in the in-between state after death. If we don't reach enlightenment, we will be reborn. That is a consensus in Buddhism. Exactly what happens after death isn't a consensus. And the Bardo Tadol is one school's kind of thoughts. Although having said that it's a minor text, Bante, my teacher, Sangharakshita, Bante is a term of reverence. He's described this as the highest and the best version of the Buddhist view of death, the highest and the best version of the Buddhist view of death. Now, the six root verses that I read during the meditation and before the meditation are part of the Bardo Tadol teachings. And Bhante's particularly encouraged members of the order to reflect on those six verses. He's given it as a meditation practice. If you do it as a meditation practice, I read it twice, but you'd learn it by heart, those verses, and then recite them to yourself seven times in a meditative way. That's one way of doing it. They're not just about death. And actually, this Bardo Tadol isn't just about death. It is very much about life and life practice. Bardo Tadol translates, it doesn't translate the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That's just Evans Wentz making it up. The actual translation of Bardo Tadol is the great liberation through hearing in the intermediate state. I don't know how they get that into Bardic at all. The great liberation through hearing in the intermediate state. The intermediate state is the bardo. The todol bit is the great liberation through hearing. So we'll come on to hearing possibly next week. But this week I want to look at what we mean by bardo. Yeah. So bardo is... it's an intermediate state. It literally means between two. Bar is between, in between, and do is two. Tibetan word. Bardo is roughly equivalent of the Sanskrit antarabhava, between being. And it's a state that is in between two other states. So the after-death state, for example, is said to be between this life and the next life. So it's an in-between state. But actually, you've got other bardos. You've got bardos all the time. Like this class, you could say, is a bardo between whatever you're doing beforehand and whatever you'll be doing next. Going home to bed, probably. Yeah, that's an in-between. Early Buddhism, though, picked out four particular bardos. The bardo of birth, taking birth, is seen as a sort of in-between state between death and this life. The bardo of life, between birth and death. The bardo of the moment of death is seen as a in-between state between, I don't know, the sort of life, living consciousness and what happens to consciousness after the death experience. The moment of death is given particular emphasis. And then there's the bardo of what happens after that moment of death. The Tibetan tradition added in two more bardos. It added in dreams and meditation. Dreams and meditation. So those six verses covered all of those. And this text is attributed to Padmasambhava. So we've got Padmasambhava, an image of Padmasambhava on the shrine. Padmasambhava is a semi-historical, semi-legendary figure who's credited with introducing the Dharma into Tibet in the 8th century. And he's also, in a way, an archetypal figure. He's a magical, mystical figure. And there's a sort of image of one of his manifestations on the shrine. Come and have a look later. Padmasambhava is said to have taught in Tibet for not very long, about 18 months. And he's said to have hidden teachings into the land in Tibet for future generations to find. It's as if he felt that the Tibetans in the 8th century weren't ready for the teachings, some of the teachings that he had to give. And he hid them in mountain caves, in buried places, in under rocks, etc., all over the land of Tibet. They're called termas. They're hidden treasures. He also is said to have hidden them in reality itself, in mind itself. And this text, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Todol, is said to be a terma that was found in the 14th century by a man called Karmalingpa. Rigsin Karmalingpa. And I think what's said to have happened is that he found some scrolls in some, I don't know where, in Tibet, that had some mystical, magical script, a few characters, and that triggered in him a memory of this text. So he was a mystical figure, and much of Tibetan tradition, teachings, are these hidden texts left by Padmasambhava. He's said to have planted them literally in the earth, but also in people's minds. And Karmalingpa was one of those people. So there's another, there's a thing that I want to talk about, which is the view behind this text. If we can sort of understand the view, we're in a better position to understand what these root verses are saying. So the view is, first of all, that each of these in-between states, and there's life, dreams, meditation, the moment of death, the after-death state, which is called the Dharmata, and the Bardo of rebirth, of taking rebirth, each of those offers an opportunity for enlightenment. That each of those is an opportunity to wake up to how things really are. I said that common sense reality is definitely not how things are. Buddhism says enlightenment is a seeing of how things really are, how they really are. It's not necessarily seeing with these physical senses. It's a deeper faculty that sees. So seeing is a sort of a metaphor here. And each of these states or conscious modes of consciousness is an opportunity for waking up. Life, dreams, meditation, the moment of death, after death, and the moment of taking rebirth is an opportunity for waking up. Particularly, the moment of death is seen as an opportunity. And we're going to come on to that, not next week, but the week after. So don't die before then. You need the teaching of what to do at the moment of death. And tune in, or come here, better still. Life, dreams, meditation, the moment of death, the after-death state and rebirth, they're all opportunities. They're seen as different modes of consciousness. Just as the dream consciousness is different to the waking consciousness, so is the after-death consciousness. Yeah. So there's a deeper sort of philosophical view behind the text, which is something, well, it's from a school of Buddhism called the Yogacara, which talks about mind only. The Yogacara, which is one philosophical school of Buddhism, a later kind of school, developed through people's meditative experiences. And it says, look, rather than matter being the primary reality, mind is the primary reality. Consciousness is the primary reality. And this material world is a manifestation of mind, not the other way around. That might seem outrageous, partly it's a meditative vision, but perhaps you could just reflect on the fact that every experience you have, even now, of me speaking, or you seeing me and other people in this room, or you sitting on cushions or chairs, the physical experience, the sounds, the sights, every experience that you have is happening in and through consciousness, in and through mind. We don't know anything about matter apart from what's mediated through mind. It's that way round. You know you're conscious, you don't actually know. You can't be sure what you're conscious of. It's that way around. Yeah. That's what Convinci and McGilchrist, or that's one of the things he says about consciousness being primary. He says that, after all that we know of matter is through the mind. Yeah. We do know that we're conscious. So the view of the Yogacara is that mind is the primary reality. And then you've got three levels in this model. It's a model. Three levels of what mind is. And I'm going to just try and give you a very brief overview of what that model is. The sort of topmost level is to do with sense experience through our five physical senses, and then what's called in a way the common sense. Mind is seen as another sixth sense. So sights, sounds, tastes, smells, and touch are seen as Well, those experiences happen in mind. That's the first level of mind. Also, you have thoughts and images that happen in your consciousness. That's the sixth mind sense. So you've got basic sense perception and basic functionings of mind. They're the sort of six primary consciousnesses. They're the top level. Sight, sound, smells, taste, touch. And Buddhism says that, at that level of seeing and hearing and so forth, there's not a problem. A Buddha, an enlightened being, would see and hear just as we do. While the Buddha had a body, even after enlightenment, while he had a body, his five physical senses would operate just like ours does. Yeah, it's not like he'd suddenly see another world. That's the sort of first layer of mind. Underneath that, we have another layer, and that's where the delusion starts. That's where us unenlightened beings get it very wrong. At that second layer, according to this model, there's an assumption made, and it's not a conscious assumption, it's pre-conscious. At that second level of mind, an assumption is made that there's a real me in here, and there's a not me, which is the rest of the world, out there. We bifurcate experience into in here, out there, and we identify this body and what happens, sort of thoughts and feelings in my mind, as me, and everything else is out there. Yeah. So we separate ourselves. And Buddhism says, look, that's the fundamental delusion. That's the fundamental problem. And it's not a conscious delusion. It's not conscious, it's instinct. All unenlightened human beings are born with that instinct. They have this sense. Actually, very small babies probably don't have any sense of self. But pretty soon, they develop a sense of being separate, having a sense of self that's identified with the body and with the thoughts and images, and everything else is out there. Yeah. Does that make sense? Let's just look at that assumption and see if you can start. I just want to see if we can start to question that assumption. You can do that just by taking the experience of seeing things. So if you take, you can do this with sounds and the other senses, but let's just take sight. So you're looking at me, hopefully, and you're looking at me at home, hopefully. You're seeing, you think you're seeing me, but actually you're seeing an image in your mind. Does that make sense? Like, you don't actually know what's out there. A physicist would say what's happening is that light is bouncing off me, entering into your retinas or your eyes, both your eyes, hitting the retina, being transformed into electrochemical signals that reach your brain. And then your brain somehow, this is what a sort of materialist model would be, is somehow turning those electrochemical signals into an experience of seeing. If it is just the brain is in a cavity that is in the dark. There is no light that enters the brain cavity, that skull cavity. Nevertheless, you have this experience of seeing. But actually what it is the mind having an image, creating an image, and projecting it as out there. Does that make sense? Similarly, a sound. When you hear my voice, like, where is the sound happening? And we normally think it's out there, but the experience of sound can't just be out there, can it? The experience is somewhere happening in the mind and then being projected as out there. So there are other ways of looking at this, but what I'm trying to illustrate to you is that this notion of in here and out there is actually quite a simplistic, well, it's wrong, actually. Never mind, it's simplistic. It's just, it doesn't stack up. It doesn't stack up, even from a materialist perspective. So the Yogacara model says that, look, this second level of mind has got it very wrong. And then there's a deeper level. There's a deeper level which is always uncontaminated, always pure. It's pure awareness. It's awareness itself, that's the word I'm going to use, awareness itself that isn't split into an in here, a me, and an out there, a world, or you. There's awareness itself which is not dualistic in that sense. It's an experience where there is no boundary, no real separation. And an enlightened mind would have recognized and be dwelling in that awareness itself, as well as being, as it were, a channel for that through this body and through these senses. That awareness itself is said to be, it's said to be luminous, not in the sense of light, but in the sense that it's light is used as a metaphor here. It's said to be, it's not a thing, it's said to be luminous in the sense that it knows things. It light shines on things and illuminates them. This awareness illuminates experience. So light is used as a metaphor. It's said to be boundless. It's not me or yours. It's you could say it's like a boundless universal consciousness. The Yogacara talks of the one mind. It's said to be boundless. It's said to be completely peaceful, a peace that is not affected, cannot be affected by anything that happens in this phenomenal world. It's sort of not in this phenomenal world. It's not in this world of time and space. It's said to be love. It's said to be that it is, as it were, love combined with wisdom. If you could experience this awareness without boundaries, your experience would be one of metta, unbounded metta for everything that exists. It would be spontaneous empathy. It's like you would see that our physical separation is just a surface phenomenon. This deeper level of awareness is, as it were, completely without boundaries between self and other. So all of Buddhism is pointing to this deepest level of mind. All of Buddhism is saying, look, that is your true nature. That is your actual birthright. That is what is the nature of not just you and me, but the nature of everything. It's all awareness made manifest. We don't realize it because not only do we separate our experience into me and not me, we then cling to that separation. We cling to the notion of self, a me that's a separate fixed entity in here. So the Yogacara model is trying to give you a model of what the unenlightened mind does and the potential to realize enlightenment. Because at the deepest level of mind, there is this awareness itself, which isn't a thing. You can't turn it into a thing. It's not a world of things. It's what makes things known. It's what illuminates things. But because that's at the deepest level of consciousness, deepest level of mind, enlightenment is possible. Enlightenment is possible. And these six root verses are saying, look, in every moment of experience, be that waking consciousness or dream consciousness or meditation consciousness or the moment of death, it's possible to realize this awareness. It's possible to realize it. And then the root verses tell you how to realize it. They tell you how to. So there's specific instructions as to what to do to realize this awareness itself. The reason that They're quite, I mean, you may have thought they're long, but actually they're quite short, is that there's a lot of unpacking to do. And I'm not going to be able to go through all six root verses in these 3 days. But I do want to look at life, the moment of death, and what happens after death. Dreams and meditation, I'll leave for you to figure out, yeah? Well, in dreams, actually, what I don't do this, but I've never done this or never had a lucid dream. Has anybody had a lucid dream? Wow, a lot of you. Right, so about a quarter of you have had a lucid dream. A lucid dream, does anybody want to explain what it is? I mean, somebody who's had it. No. Go on.
My experience of it is you become aware that you're dreaming.
Yeah.
And can make conscious decisions from there within the dream.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm just going to repeat that, particularly for people online, if they didn't hear you. What's your name?
Liam.
Yeah, Liam was saying that in a lucid dream, you become aware that you're dreaming. So you become aware that you're dreaming, and then you can make conscious decisions about how you direct that dream. Typically, people go and have sex. I'm not saying you did, Liam, or try to. Bandhase said, look, if you have a lucid dream, go and meet the Buddha. Go and sit with the Buddha. I had a friend of mine who had a lucid dream, and he didn't go and sit with the Buddha, actually. He went and sat with Bandhe, who wasn't alive then, and he said it was extraordinary. Suddenly, his whole consciousness expanded into radiant white light, and all these teachings that I'm trying to tell you about, this separation, this dualism, this delusion, all vanished. And all he did was to go and sit with Bhante. So if you're fortunate enough to have a lucid dream and you can direct it, you know, don't just fly around enjoying yourself. See if you can go and sit with Bhante or go and sit with the Buddha and see what it does to your consciousness. Yeah, see what it does to your consciousness. So in the Tibetan tradition, you train in lucid dreaming. You train in staying aware in your dreams. I've never trained in that, so I've never had a lucid dream. You don't have to be in the Tibetan tradition. Many people do that sort of training or have them spontaneously. You might have one tonight. Actually, one of the things that you're meant to do before you go to sleep is have an intention that you're going to wake up in your dream. Yeah. The interesting thing, maybe I'll say one more thing about dreams and then move on. The interesting thing about that sort of state of becoming aware that you're dreaming in your dream is that is also a metaphor for what we need to do in this waking consciousness. It's like this waking consciousness is compared to a dream state. We've got it somehow wrong, and Buddhism would say that it's a bit like we're dreaming and we don't know it, and we need to wake up. That's what enlightenment would be, that we need to wake up. We're taking our sense experience literally. And that's why we're still asleep. We take sense experience literally. And again, I was trying to point out that our senses and our common sense is not literally what's going on. It can't be what's going on. Matter is not what's going on. Our sense experiences are, like if you had different sense apparatus, if you were a fly, literally on the wall, you would have a very different experience of being in this room. Our sense experience is contingent on having particular types of senses in and a human body, and we take it literally. We think that this is what is real. In a dream, you wake up and you realize that it's a dream. I did this, I didn't do a dream, but I did a lucid dream. But a friend of mine works in virtual reality, he does He's an artist. He stayed with us for a while. He's an artist in residence in some sort of place in Barcelona where he just creates virtual reality worlds. Anyway, he lent me his headset. And so I put on this virtual reality headset. Who's done that? Loads of you. Goodness, I've never kind of even thought of doing this. And I was in my room, in my bedroom, and I entered into the universe. I was suddenly in the galaxy. And, you know, I was walking around. These planets would appear. I was touching the rings of Saturn. I went and poked my head into the sun. It was extraordinary. Now, all the time, you know, and there was Jupiter and a black hole. I went into a black hole, and then that black hole, while I was in it, combined or collided with another one. And there was fireworks. It was extraordinary. When I took the headset off, of course, it's also slightly discombobulating to find yourself back in your room, just taking this off. But all the time that I had my headset on, I was sort of aware that it wasn't real. You know, I was enjoying the experience, and it was very convincing in a certain sense. I don't know, I can't quite understand it how it does it, but it was very convincing. And you're aware that it's not real. That would be how an enlightened being saw this waking life. They would be able to function, able to have their breakfast and ask for things and communicate in the way that we do. And they would be aware that it's not real, and their minds would be in touch with this deeper level of awareness all the time. Does that make sense? So dreams are an analogy for that. And then there's meditation. So this part of why you meditate in the Buddhist tradition is you need to have a sort of concentrated mind for these teachings to reach a level of mind that is below consciousness. This sort of what we're doing now, listening to the Dharma, or me talking about the Dharma, is addressing hopefully the conscious mind, but that's only the surface. Meditation is needed for these teachings to go deeper. In a meditative state, you become very absorbed and potentially very receptive, and it's as if suddenly sometimes you have a sort of waking up moment, an aha moment. That's partly why we're meditating. Okay, let me just pause there and see if there are any questions before I start to wrap up. Yeah.
Thanks for the talk, really interesting. This idea of the mind, the awareness below the conscious mind,
yeah.
Is there any overlap in your view between that and, say, the notion of the subconscious in psychoanalysis?
I think it's a different, it might be overlapping, but it comes from such a different discourse that I wouldn't want to draw kind of comparisons, if you see what I mean. It comes from a very, very different discourse. Certainly if you meditate, you will start to remember things that you might have forgotten, and things that I guess modern therapy would say is in the subconscious becomes more conscious. And you may even enter into an archetypal kind of world of images that become vivid. Yeah, so meditation definitely does lead to memories and feelings that aren't that conscious. In a way, meditation should come with a health warning. We don't normally give you a health warning when we introduce you to meditation. A lot of people come in order to relax, and it does help you relax. It will help you have a clearer mind. It will help you, in a way, live more consciously and deliberately. It can have a calming effect on things like anxiety and, just an overactive mind. It'll help you with that, but it should come with a health warning that actually also will open up aspects of your mind that you may not have been very conscious of. And sometimes what opens up isn't very pretty. When I started to meditate, you know, particularly doing this loving kindness meditation, the Metta Bhavana, I thought I was quite a nice guy. I start to meditate and I just feel all this rage. Not all the time, I mean, not, you know, but there was more and more rage and anger in my experience. And it was obvious to me that that had been there all the time. I just wasn't very conscious of it. So meditation will bring up deeper things, not just, as it were, painful things. It can also lead to heightened states of consciousness that are extremely pleasurable. I mean, more pleasurable than anything that you can experience through the physical senses. It's like when those senses calm down, meditation can open up experiences that are sort of bliss and beyond. So that too can happen. It's like the mind that we normally occupy is a very narrow bandwidth, and meditation opens the whole thing up. But this deeper level of awareness, I would say it's even below what we would regard in the West as subconscious. It's somehow below everything. It's not even in time and space. Yeah. One more? Yeah, go on.
How do you kind of hold that awareness in your head of sense perception and common sense perception not being the ultimate reality without kind of that those being thoughts in your head that you're telling yourself?
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, in a way, I wouldn't advise trying to hold it in your head. If you do want to do it, then you do need some guidance in meditation as to how to do it. And you probably need some sort of guidance if you're doing it regularly, you need some guidance. The reason I say that is that if you get it, if you misunderstand these teachings, it can lead to a bit of an alienated state where you think, oh my God, nothing's real, and I feel alienated from everything. Does that make sense? Whereas done properly, it leads you into an expansive state where you feel connected with everything. And a test of that is that, well, there are lots of tests, I guess, but one is that the world starts to look more beautiful. Everything starts to look more beautiful. It's like you start seeing with the eye of the artist. You know how an artist maybe paints a still life, or maybe better still, a film director might portray even ugly things with the eye of an artist. It's like you start seeing everything as beautiful. The other test, if it's working, is that you feel love. You feel connected with everything, with life. You have a resonance with life. You don't feel separate. If you sort of do those meditations in a way that doesn't work, then you feel more alienated. So I'm giving you, in a way, some of the theory. I'm not sort of giving you the how. To do the how, well, I'd say keep practicing Buddhism, keep coming here to Dharma Night, go on retreat, ask for ordination, get ordained, train to be ordained. At ordination, we introduce you to practices which help you see things as they really are. And maybe I'll come on to that next week, why context is so important for these teachings. These teachings come from a tradition, and the tradition has all sorts of safeguards and a whole context, including a teacher who will guide you. They're not things to be messing around with. In a way, one of the things that I think we get very wrong these days is decontextualizing these teachings. So look, I'm going to wrap up now. I haven't really got more time for questions. All I want to say is that, well, in summary, you've got these root verses, which are instructions on how to wake up to enlightenment, the view behind them is that any state of consciousness, it's possible to become enlightened in. And partly that's because, well, you could say it is because at the deepest level of mind, awareness is all there is. Enlightened awareness is all there is, you could say. That's the deepest level of mind. And next week, we'll start looking at what the verses say about how to work in everyday life with that. And I'll come on to context a bit more. But should we finish by just hearing the verses one more time? Yeah? Okay, good. So yeah, you might want to settle into a more comfortable position. So yeah, as I said, don't worry if you can't, if you can just let these verses go in. This Bardo Tadol is about letting, hearing the Dharma and letting it go in, even if you don't understand it all. The root verses of the six Bardos. Oh, now when the Bardo of life upon me is dawning, abandoning idleness, there being no idleness in a devotee's life, entering into the reality undistractedly, listening, reflecting, meditating, carrying on to the path knowledge of the true nature of appearances and of mind, may the Trikaya be realized. Once that the human form has been attained, may there be no time or opportunity in which to idle it away. O now, when the Bardo of dreams upon me is dawning, abandoning the inordinate corpse-like sleeping of the sleep of stupidity, may the consciousness undistractedly be kept in its natural state. Comprehending the true nature of dreams, may I train myself in the clear light of miraculous transformation. Acting not like the brutes in slothfulness, may the blending of the practicing of the sleep state and the actual or waking experience be highly valued by me. O now, when the Bardo of meditation upon me is dawning, abandoning the whole mass of distractions and illusions, may the mind be kept at rest in endless, undistracted samadhi. May firmness in both the visualizing and in the perfecting stages be obtained. At this time, when meditating one-pointedly, with all other actions put aside, may I not fall under the power of misleading, stupefying passions. O now, when the Bardo of the moment of death upon me is dawning, abandoning attraction and craving and weakness for all worldly things, may I be undistracted in the space of the bright, enlightening teachings. May I be able to transfuse myself into the heavenly space of the unborn. The hour has come to be parted with this body composed of flesh and blood. May I know the body to be impermanent and illusory. O now, when the Bardo of reality upon me is dawning, abandoning all awe, fear, and terror of all phenomena, may I recognize whatever appears as being my own thought forms. May I know them to be apparitions in the intermediate state. It has been said there arrives a time when the chief turning point is reached. Fear not the bands of the peaceful and wrathful, who are your own thought forms. O now, when the bardo of taking rebirth upon me is dawning, one-pointedly holding fast to a single wish, may I be able to continue the course of good deeds through repeated effort. May the womb door be closed and revulsion recollected. The hour has come when energy and pure love are needed. May I cast off jealousy and meditate upon the Guru, the Father Mother. O procrastinating one, who thinks not of the coming of death, if devoting yourself to the useless doings of this life, improvident are you in dissipating your great opportunity. Mistaken indeed will your purpose be now if you return empty-handed from this life. Since the holy Dharma is known to be your true need, will you not devote yourself to the holy Dharma even now? Good, we'll leave it there for this week. Thank you very much. See you next week.